On the outside, Judith Barcy seemed to have it all. At just 10 years old, she'd appeared in multiple film and TV roles. She'd been in Cheers and Jaws, The Revenge, amongst dozens of others. Sadly, her father, Joseph, wasn't quite on board with his daughter's success. He was a deeply insecure man and terrified that she would eclipse him completely. He decided to take matters into his own hands. Hollywood's latest rising star had a light snubbed out far, far too soon. This is the case of Judith Barcy. I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. Oh, today's case is, as ever, really sad, but it leaves you just considering the malevolence of certain human beings. You can't help when you hear this story, but stand in astonishment, open-mouthed, at why the killing I'm going to talk about today occurs. Because when you look at the story as it unfolds, to all intents and purposes, this should be a story of celebration, of success, of overcoming challenges, and making it to a place and position that so few people ever achieve. But often, no matter how shiny and amazing things can look from the outside, behind closed doors, it can be an entirely different story. And the case of Judith Barcy absolutely examples this. So let's start with her parents. Who were they? Where did they come from? What created and formed them? So Judith was the daughter of Joseph and Maria Barcy. Now, they were both immigrants that actually fled to the US from the Hungarian People's Republic. That was following the Hungarian uprising of 1956. So they had fled for a new life, a better life, the American dream, as Gatsby would say in The Great Gatsby, the idea that there was something beautiful and possible, full of potential in the land of the free. And you can imagine that there will be lots of obstacles and struggles for people who are immigrants to the country, because you're dealing in the 50s with quite a lot of social unrest and prejudice, and therefore that's going to make it more challenging to succeed. You're going to have to deal with the general prejudice in your community because you sound different, look different, come from a different world. And you're also going to have to try to find a way to financially stabilize yourself and become economically successful. So understandably, there are challenges aside from the obvious, which is the language barrier. So we can see that psychologically, people who have to go on these new journeys, there is this positive side, but often there are lots of pitfalls and problems that need to be overcome. Now, Judith's mother, she was actually from a rural southern university town, whereas he, her father, was from an industrial area. And allegedly, he actually had a very miserable childhood. So he didn't have a nice experience at all. And one of the things that stood out for him that was problematic was he was bullied a lot. Mostly it was because his dad had abandoned the family, and also because economically they struggled a great deal. So they were very poor. And anybody who's ever had a childhood that has been cloaked in poverty knows that, like it or otherwise, you stand out. People notice that your shoes aren't nice or that your clothes are worn, and differences always make you more vulnerable. It's a sad truth. So Joseph is obviously in a scenario where he has to go through the motions on a daily basis as being seen for different because of the fact that his father isn't present, but also because he doesn't look the way that other students look because of his economic situation. Now, Joseph and Maria didn't actually immigrate at the same time. It was at different times, so they came to the US separately, but they actually met at a restaurant in California. Now, this is where Maria worked as a waitress and Joseph worked as a plumber, and this is how their worlds collided, essentially. Apparently, the restaurant was a well-known gathering place for emigres, so it was a place where if you had come to the country, it wasn't your home country, you would go there and know that you were going to meet lots of people with similar stories. And we all know it's really helpful to have compatibility in relationship, goes without saying. But compatibility is often about shared experiences, and therefore Joseph and Maria have shared experiences. They've come to America, they'll have had their struggles, etc. And essentially, this is how they connect. And he's actually known in that restaurant as Arizona Joe. Briefly, he'd lived in Arizona before moving to California, but that was why they gave him the name. Joe, where'd you come from? Well, I come from Hungary, but I have once been in Arizona for a short period of time. We're going to call you Arizona Joe. It's so funny how nicknames happen, but that's what happened. So Arizona Joe. One of the things I would say is back in Arizona, he was known to be very violent. He had quite a reputation. And when you have this kind of behavior in your past, it's often not a very positive predictor about the way you're going to be in the future. And it does seem that violence is a part of who he is. It runs in the cells of his body. He would usually just sit at the bar to drink by himself. Again, I get it. People need to escape. People need to unwind. People need to have space. And maybe some people choose a bar to go and do that. Personally, I've always found it a little bit weird when somebody regularly goes to a place and drinks by themselves. It either tells me there's probably an alcohol problem, or the other thing it tells me is they don't have very many friends. And if they don't have many of any friends, why? It's usually an indicator. And I know that some people will say, well, people are lonely. That's why they go in and they drink and they're hoping to meet people. But if you're regularly in a place and you're by yourself and people regularly see that you're there, well, you wouldn't be lonely unless there was something about you that meant that people stayed away from you. So I think we kind of get it in the mark of Joseph's personality at this moment in time. He's got this violent predisposition and people know that. And also he doesn't necessarily have people surrounding him. So on a social level, there must be something about him that makes people feel uncertain. But one of the things that Maria notices is that when he's buying his drinks, he only pays with $100 bills. And if you're a young woman and some guy's by himself at the bar and he keeps paying for his drinks with $100 bills, which I would just think, listen, how much change do you have in your life? I mean, you keep paying for these drinks in $100 bills. Surely you're going to use the change. Wouldn't that be sensible? Like pay once with the $100 bill and then use some of the change so that you're not walking around clinging with the noise of coins. I'm just throwing it out there. But the very fact that she's impressed by this is because she's not thinking about the obvious thing I've just said. You don't need to keep paying with $100 bills because you got all the change from the original $100 bills. You know, at the end of the day, he's doing it because he wants to suggest he's successful. An image, that means, is really important to him. Because for the most part, as human beings, we don't care what we pay with. At the end of the day, if we've got the cash, it's the same cash that's required for that particular drink, whether you pay a $100 bill or a $10 bill, or as I would have done at university, with whatever coins I found from behind my sofa. And I know that some of you who are my age will remember doing things like that. Bear in mind, if you have a sofa at home and you've never done this, it's worth doing it. Back in the day, I would often find enough to go out and actually get myself such a said drink at a bar because I'd managed to accrue the amount from behind my sofa. Actually, a lot of people pay with cards these days, so maybe it's not quite as profitable. Anyway, I digress. If you've got a 20-year-old sofa in your home, a lot of us do, just pop behind it and have a check. But he's trying to progress himself in this way, isn't he? He's saying, you know, I am somebody who's on the way up. I am an individual who always has money, and I'm somebody, therefore, that to a female who's potentially looking for a mate is going to appear quite impressive. And it does. Maria's really interested. This guy seems to be upwardly mobile, and therefore she gets involved with him. And in 1977, they go ahead and they get married. And to be honest and to be fair to them as a couple in the early years of the marriage, apparently they were really happy. Friends said that Joseph could be quite charming, but bear that in mind, that's what they say about psychopaths as well. A lot of them can be quite charming, can't they, at the beginning? But despite the fact that he's apparently charming, Joseph had a real temper, and that temper was very much exacerbated after he'd been drinking. Again, that is something that we see within drinking behaviour. Some people are nice drunks, some people are sleepy drunks, and some people are really violent, nasty drunks. And it seems that he falls into that latter category. Also, he had a real issue with the fact that he had a Hungarian accent. So, as we all know, if somebody has an accent, it doesn't matter where the accent is from. If you and me meet, and some people may find this offensive, I am sorry if you find what I'm about to say offensive. The world has changed significantly since when I was a teenager. And I'm still the person I was when I was a teenager, just with a lot more bills and responsibilities. But she, the teenage me, resides very well and very alive right now. So I would still do this. If I'm chatting to you and you have a hint of an accent, it doesn't matter whether that accent is from Newcastle or Wales or Scotland or Ireland or Uganda. It doesn't matter. You bet your bottom dollar I'll be like, where's that accent from? It's not meant as an insult. When I was a kid, it was a compliment because it meant I actually was listening to you and, dare I say it, was interested in who you were. But these days, apparently, asking people things like that can be offensive. I would have asked Joseph where he's from. In fact, my Hungarian friend had that happen to her the day I met her. Where is your accent from? Because it clearly wasn't an accent I was familiar with. And she just replied, Hungary. So she too came from Hungary, as did Joseph. But if I'd asked Joseph where he'd come from, it wouldn't have ended well. Apparently, if you asked him where he came from because of his accent, he would basically resort to violence. So not only would he have been offended, I would have been aggressed. So again, that says something about a sense of shame. Our accents are just a part of our fabric of being. They're a part of our history. They express and explain some of our commonalities if we share our space with people who also come from those places. And it basically is a talking point because, of course, you know it's an accent. You shouldn't be ashamed of that. You shouldn't be fearful of people recognising that about you. And the fact that he wants to hide it, and when people just point it out, he gets so angry that he gets violent, that speaks of a real deep insecurity. And if you think about an individual who's narcissistic at core, they always want to be seen as bigger, better, bolder. They want to be seen as the winners in life. But often they have this absolute core inferiority at the centre. And certainly what he does, where that accent is concerned, would suggest that potentially those narcissistic traits exist. He wants to be seen as this all-American, as opposed to being seen as this beautiful mix of history and ethnicity, something that the vast majority of people would be proud of. He also had this propensity for violence across the board. So he liked to get involved in bar fights. He liked to get violent with people who crossed him. And he was somebody who bragged about that. So he actually told one of his friends, a guy called Peter Kivlin, that he'd lost vision in one of his eyes in a fight. And he even said that this was such a prolific fight that he served time in prison in New York for killing a man in a brawl. Probably not the best thing to brag about, not if you want mates. Hey, Joseph, you know how you end up being at that bar by yourself quite a lot? Yes. Do you think that's got anything to do with the fact that you punch people who just notice your accent?
Possibly.
Do you also think it's that you tell people that you've killed somebody?
Maybe. Excuse me, I'm just going to pay with this $100 bill. I'll have a Perrier water. Take this very large note. I would say keep the change, but that would be ridiculous and very economically poor judgment.
Anyway, the point is, this is what he's telling people. It's actually, there's no record of this either. So even though he did have some criminal activity, it was 3 arrests for drunk driving. But again, let's think about psychopathy. What do psychopaths do? They lie. They love to lie. They like to create a fabric of absolute BS. They like to create a narrative that they know is false, but they convince others it's true. And part of that is for the ego. They like the fact that people are afraid of them. But also a lot of it is to do with the fact that they enjoy messing with reality. And they know that you're not going to be able to figure out whether what they're saying is true. And he likes the idea of being feared. Let's bring in some Machiavellian traits there as well. They like to be feared. In fact, they'd much rather be feared than liked. So we're really seeing the dark triad of personality traits when we're starting to talk about this particular individual. Now, in spite of the fact that these two are initially happy in their marriage, it is not going to last. It's as simple as that. But as is the case in so many traditional relationships, they go ahead and have a child. So Judith Barcy is born on the 6th of June, 1978 in Los Angeles. She was the couple's only child. And What did people say about Judith? Well, just wonderful stuff. That's the only way to describe her. So people said that she was incredibly kind-hearted. One of her neighbours who knew her well said that she was somebody who had the manners of an angel. And they talked about the fact that she had favourite colours such as pink and purple. So an angelic little girl and a girly girl. But she was somebody, when people were around her, that lit up the room. But also, like I said, that just had the etiquette that not all children have. Not all children have the manners of an angel. I am the mother to three children. My children are very well mannered, but they are quite rambunctious, shall we say, as children. If there was something that they could fall into, they'd fall into it. If you had a beautiful white carpet and there was only one puddle with mud in a 100 metre radius, they'd find it and they'd bathe in it. And they'd probably get our dog to bathe in it too. And then in their loving, innocent, naive ways, they'd just run into the house. My cream carpets lasted for less than 6 months. Just throwing it out there. What I'm saying is there is something really quite special about this girl, and she is special. Now, Joseph, he had made it very clear that he wanted his wife, Maria, to be a very traditional mother. So he wanted her to be a stay-at-home mum. He wanted her to be able to prepare the home, make sure that dinner was on the plate when he got back from work, and essentially be a home carer and a homemaker. And there is absolutely nothing wrong with those traditional values and the way that certain people choose to live in those traditional roles. But I do feel that Maria would have liked more for her life. I don't mean that she didn't love being a mother, she did. But what I'm saying is I think that she probably had ambition, but it's a time frame in society where women are still, for the most part, staying at home. My own mother was a stay-at-home mum. It was one of those things that seemed to be the fabric of society at the time. So even if you had a job like my own mother, and my mother was paid more than my father when she got married and had her first child, but as soon as she had her first child, it was over for her career-wise. She stayed at home. I'm not saying that was a bad thing. It was fine. But I'm saying that it was just this culture of expectation. So even though he wants her to stay at home, the reality is the cultural experience of America and actually the Western world very much reflected that. So it's not just a Joseph thing. It's a mum thing and a woman thing in society at that moment in time. So she obviously has a lot of fire within her about what she could possibly have done and been, knows that she's going to be this stay-at-home parent and thinks to herself, well, you know what? My daughter, my girl, she's going to have the success that maybe I'm going to be denied. And so a mother almost immediately begins training her daughter for this acting career in Hollywood. And you can imagine what people are saying when Maria's saying, Judith is going to be a star. Judith is going to be a Hollywood actress. Judith is going to be a success. You've got 99% of people, including all of her family members, basically saying, you are wasting your time. Her brother said, you are wasting your time. You're being ridiculous. There's absolutely no way your daughter is going to be able to succeed in this unbelievably challenging field. You don't have the contacts. Why would they pick her when there are all these other people who are already in the queue? But Maria didn't give up. And she worked really hard, so she gave Judith lessons in posture, in poise, and in voice. And it pays off. When Judith is 5 years of age, she's actually scouted while she's ice skating. And she's scouted by a camera crew. So she stands out. And part of that is because Maria makes her stand out. Part of that is because Maria believes that her daughter is super special. Also, it's obvious from the pictures that I'm putting up that the girl is gorgeous. She's a beautiful child. All children are beautiful, let's be honest. But some are just blessed by nature. It's the way it goes. Some people get to be born and grow up into supermodels. It's just the way it works for certain genetically blessed people. I wouldn't know, as I'm just really ordinary and quite a dinted tin with a goofy face. But I'm saying that when you think about children, she's the angelic, perfect poster child of a child of that era. And people notice her. And the fact that she's being trained to ice skate, again, it demonstrates the level of commitment that her mother is also giving their situation. Now, Judith immediately gets an agent at this point, a woman called Ruth Hansen, and it was a good choice because she specialised in child performers, and she becomes a pretty instant success. So she becomes a successful commercial actress. She was in 72 commercials. Now, bear in mind, we're talking about a child here. 72 commercials is a huge amount of success. So she worked for McDonald's, Lay's, Campbell's Soup. She genuinely was somebody that was picture perfect, did really well on the day and set, and was somebody that was a sure thing when it came down to getting the job done. And she's really young, so she stands out also because of her professionalism. Now this, of course, because of her looks, because of her ethic, her attitude, her capability, her skill and talent, it opens the door for Judith to get more serious roles. Now, Judith's first TV role, it was in a programme called Fatal Vision. She played Kimberly McDonald, and ironically, that character is a child who's murdered by her father. It really feels prophetic that that first TV role plays out that way. And you'll understand that when we get to the end of this sad story. She also had several film roles. So she was in Jaws, The Revenge. This is where she played a little girl there named Thea Brody. Also, she did voice work. So she provided the voices of Anne-Marie in All Dogs Go to Heaven and Ducky in The Land Before Time. So we are talking about a child who is going on the Drew Barrymore journey, essentially. She's been spotted. She's been courted by all of these TV programs. She's moved into film. And we know what the trajectory, as long as she is looked after and provided with the right support and given the right opportunities and advice, that she can go the distance. Now, there is another thing that might be challenging for her, but is actually quite positive for her career. So she's quite short for her age. So she stood about 3'8" at the age of 10, which means that whilst her contemporaries are clearly growing up, getting to that prepubescent early onset adolescent age, she is still short. Now, they start giving her hormone injections at UCLA because they want to encourage her growth. And we understand that she would want to get to be a little bit taller. But for the casting directors, they are literally rubbing their hands together. Because if you've got a girl who's older, who's more capable, who's got more experience, but looks young, well, that's going to be perfect. So Ruth Hansen said that when she was 10 years of age, she was still playing 7-year-olds. And that means that the casting directors and those who are producing the film, they're going to get more bang for their buck, essentially, because let's be honest, she's going to work harder, do better, be more professional because of her experience and because of her age, and yet she plays a really young child. Now, by the time Judith started fourth grade, that's the UK equivalent year 5, she was earning an estimated $100,000 a year. That's a huge amount of money. So if we were thinking about now, that would be the value of about $260,000 a year. And she's a kid. You'd think her family would be absolutely mind blown because it's helping them. In 1985, they were able to buy a 3-bedroom house in West Hills, Los Angeles. Now, it's not a huge house, it was modest, but this is incredible. Their child is providing them with a life that they couldn't have dreamt of before. And Hansen, her agent, actually called her client a bubbly, happy little girl and said that when she was working, she just really enjoyed the work. She didn't struggle. She wasn't precocious, problematic. She was just a really hard worker who got the best from her day. Now, one would hope at this point that her family become even more fused and close together because it's really working out. Maria's put the hard work in. Judith is excelling in this field. Financially, as a family, they're doing really well. So Joseph should be thrilled. But that's not how it works out. Because as I said, Joseph has some issues. He's a very angry, violent man, but also now he becomes an alcoholic. And as he becomes more addicted and dependent to alcohol, so too does he increase in his angry and violent outbursts. And then the jealousy begins, the paranoia, the insecurity, and then he's bitter, really bitter towards Judith's success. In fact, he couldn't cope with the fact that at 8 years of age, she'd made far more money and accomplished far more than he ever would. But as opposed to being able to celebrate that, as we'd imagine, as opposed to seeing that he was part of the cultivation of the success and that his daughter was a cultivation of what he created along with his wife. He can't. He sees her as the enemy, a reminder of everything he isn't and everything that she possibly may become. And it eats him up. And several sources said that Joseph would just threaten his family and just openly talk about this. So sometimes he'd say to people he knew that he was going to kill his wife. Other times he'd say that he was going to kill himself. And then he'd kill Judith. And then if he killed Judith and himself, then he'd leave Maria alive to suffer. So this really macabre and malevolent mindset of how do I cause the deepest of pain to people that I love? Do I kill myself? Probably that's not enough. Maybe Maria would be relieved, but what if I kill myself and Judith? Well, then Maria will have to live with the agony of not having her daughter, her income, or me present. Or maybe I'll just kill my wife. That will cause Judith pain and that will destroy the stability that she feels. The fact that he's even playing with these ideas, toying with these ideas, it demonstrates just how dark a human being he is. But of course, when people are drunk, a lot of people just believe that they're just talking BS. They don't realize that sometimes they're speaking the truth. Sometimes those threats, they're actually building to a reality. Now, friends said that Joseph's world basically at the same time revolved around Judith. But even though he had this bitter resentment, and even though he still at times seemed to embrace the fact that he was a father and suggest that he would do anything for his daughter, it really was more that he wanted to create control. So it wasn't that his world revolved around her because he revered her, he loved her, he wanted her to succeed. It was that he wanted ultimate control over her world. We're not talking about a doting, loving father. We're talking about a malevolent, dominant force, a force that believes that Judith is his. She belongs to him. She's a possession. And the problem with people who feel that way is you can learn that you no longer are willing to have that possession. You can throw that possession away. You can harm that possession. When we have that territorial belief that we have power and dominance over something that we believe belongs to us, well, if we choose, we can throw it by the wayside. Once Maria actually bought Judith a special kite. You do that, don't you? How many of us with children or who have access to children that we love in our lives have not surprised them? There is something so ultimately satisfying and wonderful when you present a child with something they didn't know they were going to get and they're so excited. And Judith is earning a shed load of money. She deserves to be treated. She's literally bought them a home. And her mother clearly wants her to know what a special child that she is. And she buys her a special kite. And her father, Joseph, just grabs it off her. Now, Judith, at this moment in time, knows that something bad is going to happen to that kite. And she gets really upset. She gets quite hysterical. She says, "You're going to break it." And then Joseph says to his wife, Maria, "Look at her. She's just a spoiled brat. And she doesn't share her new toy." And then he broke it into as many pieces as he could. A neighbour actually recounted that happening. What kind of insecure human being would do that to a kid? To actually suggest that she won't share her new toy? No, you're a grown-ass man. Why would she share the toy with you? Maybe if you'd suggested, "Let's go fly this kite," she would have been thrilled. But that's not what happened. Joseph wanted her to know that he was powerful, that he could take from her, that whatever she had, he could choose to destroy in a heartbeat if he wished to. And it breaks her heart. She knows ultimately that this is his predisposition and she wants that kite. It's special to her. It's a present of her mother. And then in a moment, it's just smashed into a million pieces because he wants to punish her for being successful. He calls her spoilt. You're not spoiled when somebody as a child presents you with a present and you're excited. You're just a child. But then I don't think Joseph ever saw her as a child. I think she was his piggy bank. But also, I think she was the individual that he looked at and resented because she was better than him. Even at 8 years of age, she was better than him and he knew it. Apparently, the neighbours who knew Joseph really felt that there was something odd about him. He was a deeply suspicious and paranoid man, as well as being aggressive, as well as being an alcoholic. But as soon as the family moved in, he actually erected this spiked fence around the entire property. No other family did that. And so it felt left field, it felt off. And one can say, well, you know, he came from a country that had some political problems and instability. Maybe it was because he had this deep entrenched perspective that he needed to keep his family safe. And that could be one explanation, but it could also be that he wanted to keep people out. He didn't want people involved in his business. He wanted to be able to do whatever he wanted to do to his family without the prying eyes of the neighbours. And that, I think, is how the neighbours felt, that there was something unusual, something dark about him doing that. Now, although most of the abuse that Joseph actually inflicted to his family was verbal, one of the things that happens is that his wife, Maria, files a police report against him in December 1986. Now, this police report is apparently filed because she accuses him of threatening to kill her over the last 5 years. And also, she accuses him of choking her and hitting her in the face. Let's be honest, this will definitely have happened. But wow, 5 years. She's talking about the fact he's been threatening to kill her for 5 years. Also, we know this is true, because since the crime that we're going to talk about played out, many people came forward and said, yeah, he used to talk openly about wanting to kill them. But there is a moment clearly for her where she's thinking, this could become a reality. No, maybe it's the physical violence, the choking her, the hitting her in the face. Suddenly, she can't ignore those threats. There's an escalation in the way that he's becoming towards her and he's getting more violent. Now, I really struggle when these kind of things happen, because what we know is that many, many people in relationships are really bullied by their partner. They have to suffer screaming and shouting and being called horrible names. And whilst it's not physically violent, you know, you don't get any injuries, it still creates an injury of your mind, of your emotions. It makes you feel unsafe. And she's had years of this. And without a doubt, it's true that that's something she's endured. But the police can't physically do anything about it because they can't see it. At least today, we would potentially have an option for coercive control. This kind of abuse would not be tolerated. But back then, it's very difficult for the police to do anything. And if there's no physical injuries, if they can't see bruising, if there isn't an evidence trail that suggests that that's happened because maybe there's a witness, it's very difficult to prosecute. Also, bear in mind that what happens where abusers are concerned is they are really good at apologising. So in the heat of the moment, you'll be like, I'm going to do something with this information. I'm going to tell the authorities. I'm going to get myself safe. After the event, they will work real hard at clawing back into your world, saying that they'll never do it again, doing nice things for you. An abuser can be an abuser just 5% of the time, and 95% of the time, they can be the best partner ever. Not saying Joseph was, I'm saying that's how it works in lots of relationships. So people declining to prosecute is common, particularly if they think that the case is weak, or that the partner is going to change, or indeed that they're so scared of the partner, they think that if they carry on down that line, something truly terrible may happen to them and their child. Now, Maria's brother, a guy called Joseph Weldon, he said that after this incident, it seemed to, shall we say, sober Joseph up. There was this moment where he realized that what he'd done had actually fractured their relationship. Maria put up with a lot, but she was growing tired. So he actually gives up drinking for 2 years, which is something that's really positive. But Maria's changed. Even though he's trying, she's not accepting him working and wheedling his way back into her good graces. So then he gets tired of this. She's not doing what he wants. And bear in mind, a narcissist wants the world to work as they want the world to work. And she's not having it this time. So he starts to become abusive again. He's complaining about her housekeeping. He actually used to conduct tours, I kid you not, tours of the house with his friends to show them how bad she was at housekeeping. He'd be like, look at these piles of toys. Look at these piles of clothes that haven't been cleaned up. Joseph, you'd have been welcome around here. You would have spent an entire day doing that. Charge people. I would be totally okay with that. How many women and men out there would be like, okay, let's make some extra income if you really want to go down this road? Because I don't feel shame. I got a busy life. The clothes, the toys, they can pile up. I'll get round to it maybe this week. But obviously he's trying to humiliate Maria. He's trying to give himself a permission base as well psychologically for the way he treats her. He's pointing all of these things out to say, look at what I have to put up with. Look at how useless my wife is. And the humiliation is again a tactic that we see used by physical and coercive controllers. And without a doubt, it demonstrates his mindset's really malevolent. Who would do that to that actual partner? Bring people in to simply point out how they're failing. And also, how weird if you were one of those friends. Sorry, Joseph, what are we doing? I'm going to take you on a tour of my house. Oh, yeah. Is it a new house? No, it's just my house. The house I've been before. Yeah, the house you've been before, but this time I'm going to show you something new. Ooh, is it a shed? Have you got a shed? I've not got a shed. No, is it a pool? Have you got a pool, Joseph? It's not a pool. Have you got a bar? Are we going to be having champagne at your bar? I haven't got a bar. I haven't got a pool. I haven't got a shed. Although maybe it'd be nice to have all of those things. I haven't got them. I've got something new. Oh, great. Let's go. In you walk. Door opens. Look at that. What? That pile of clothes. Okay, Joseph, I'm not getting this. Look at that pile of toys. You've got a kid, Joseph. Yeah. Just look how bad Maria is. Joseph, I'm just going to politely back out with the worst sense of awkwardness that I've ever experienced. By the way, hi, Maria. Really sorry. Honestly, you should see my gaff. Yeah, couldn't get in the door the other week because the mail had tied so high. See ya. Honestly, imagine doing that. But that's what he did. And also, if that's not bad enough, he decides, well, you know what? In for a penny, in for a pound in the world of being a really terrible husband, so I'll just have an affair. That's what he does. In 1987, he thinks, I'll just start having sex with somebody else. And at this point, he's just showering his mistress with expensive gifts. This includes necklaces and rings. And of course, we know where that money's coming from. It's coming from Judith's earnings. And that just demonstrates the level of selfishness of this human being. He is resentful of his daughter, and yet he's using her as a cash cow so he can hang out and be frivolous with his mistress. And what's really sad is that Judith is young, of course. Clearly, we're talking about a very young girl who's working very hard to provide for her family and doing a great job. But she's also very self-aware. She knows life isn't as it should be. She knows that even though she puts on a great act in front of everybody that she does jobs for, that her world is very different at home. And she actually starts to talk about this. She said to people that she knew, afraid to go home. My dad is miserable. My dad is drunk every day. And I know he wants to kill my mother. Can you imagine being a child, a really young child, and having and holding that fear and believing that your father has that potential? Listen, we all say things that we regret. I'm sure everybody that's listening to this has had an argument where they've been nasty or said something they shouldn't have said. But there is something about the way that Joseph acts that Judith interprets as actually having intent. She's somebody with an intuition and an instinct that these aren't just words. There's something dark behind them, something potential-based behind them. And Joseph continued, whilst he's having his affair, as he starts drinking again, to threaten his wife and daughter constantly. And he starts getting specific. Now, this is really important. People will threaten people. We see it all the time. And those threats are empty. They're empty threats. They're not going to go through with anything. And saying to somebody, I want to kill you, it's horrific. And my God, no one should utter those words to man, woman, child, or in fact, animal. No one. It's abusive. End of. I really struggle when people don't understand the intent that is felt through words, even when they're not meant. You have to remember that on the receiving end of those kind of words, you don't know the history of a human being. You don't know their experience in their lives. You don't know what they've suffered in their backgrounds. And whilst you may say that in a moment of frustration, it can cut to the core of another person. So we should never use language like that. Same as we should never wish people dead, because you don't know how it lands. Some people can dust it off. Some people are really deeply affected by it. But he's saying that he wants to kill. We've heard this for years now. Even his wife has said to the police he's been doing this for 5 years. But then he starts to be specific. Now, like I said, people say horrible things like, I want to kill you. They shouldn't, we know that. But there is a very big difference between saying, I want to kill you in the heat of the moment and then starting to go into detail. When you start going into detail, why? It's got in your head and you started to play it out. That's why it's a bigger issue. So he starts to say that he's going to cut their throats, that he's going to burn down the family home. So now he's talking about, this is how I could do it. It's a little bit like when you're working with an individual who has suicidal ideation, sometimes they will feel that they want to take their lives, but they don't think about the specifics. So they are a risk and a serious risk, and we take that incredibly seriously in therapeutic environments. However, if they come and say, I want to take my life, and I've thought about how I'm going to do it, and I'm going to do A, B, and C, then the risk is higher because they've started to play with the potential. And it's really concerning when an ideation situation starts to move through those plans. So too, when we think about this kind of criminality, when somebody starts to imagine, have visions, create thoughts about what they are going to do to end the life of the people that they should love, it means that they are getting closer to the possibility. How often in true crime cases do we hear about the fact that the individual had threatened to kill and then started to tell people exactly what they were going to do, only for that to conclude in a horrible reality? He also starts doing some really nasty things, such as hiding a telegram that had been intended for Maria. And this telegram had been sent because one of her relatives in Hungary had died. And clearly, she needs to know that because she might want to go to the funeral. But he didn't want her to leave the US with Judith. And the reason he didn't want her to leave is he's thinking to himself, well, if she goes, she might not come back. And when you're in a very domestically abusive situation, chances are you are looking for an escape. So I'm not saying that he wasn't right in that suspicion. Although, let's be honest, she's been his long-suffering wife for quite a long period of time now. And she could have left at any point. She's chosen not to. So it feels like a paranoid, suspicious reality for him to believe that. But that's what he does. He hides that telegram. Now, of course, the bad news gets to her because she gets a phone call and she's really upset. So she confronts her husband about it. Of course, initially, he's like, I don't know anything about this. I don't know anything about this telegram that's apparently arrived. But a few hours after this, he concedes that he did and he gets the crumpled telegram out of the bin and then shows it to her again. Coercive control. Now, despite the fact that Judith really understands that her home life is not acceptable, she recognises dysfunction, she still goes about her business as an absolute perfect child. So she goes to school every day. She actually went to a public school because even though she had this job and she could have been taught on set, she wanted to have a more normal life. She wanted to experience the world as her peers experienced it. And apparently at school, she'd draw pictures quite often. She was artistic, and a lot of the pictures would depict her and her mother playing together. So she wouldn't have a father in that picture. She'd just have a mother. And even though as a teacher, you will look at that and see it as a thing of beauty, often in therapeutic environments, if we know there is a family and a child is drawing a picture of only one parent, we ask questions. And the question is, where's daddy? Or where's granddad? Or where's your other mummy? However it works in your family. Because we want to know whether the child is drawing the picture with the one parent because they feel this incredibly close connection and they're just recognising that daddy is at work and therefore he's not present in the picture. And it's not because there is an instability in the relationship. But if you ask the question, the child at times will say indeed, the reason daddy isn't in the picture is because they don't like daddy or they don't like whoever else is the primary caregiver. And that's very telling. So even though her teachers see these pictures, they're not thinking anything's going wrong because she turns up tidy, she turns up clean, she's sweet-natured, she's well-behaved. The red flags are not present for them. But like I said, when you know that there is a family and there is more than just two people in that family, you expect when they draw pictures to actually bring in other members of the family. And it's worth asking those questions if that doesn't happen. Often it's innocent, but if you ask the questions, you find out often if it's not innocent. That's why it's so powerful to read into those things a little bit more deeply. Now, Judith's friends, they were worried. They were aware of the abuse that she was dealing with, because she actually told them. She'd say things like, sometimes my daddy shouts at me, sometimes my daddy throws things at me and my mum. So she is telling the friends that she's in this domestically violent relationship. But again, back in the 80s, whilst it's mind-blowing to imagine, it was really commonplace for children to get hit. I mean, in some places, it's still quite common for children to get hit. And a lot of people will say on my channel, in the comments, well, I do hit my children, I don't do it hard, but this is the way that I chastise. You all know from watching me that I'm somebody who doesn't believe in ever raising a hand to a child or ever raising a voice to a child. And it's purely down to the fact that the results aren't positive down the line. I'm not saying you're going to damage your child horribly. I'm just saying that behaviorally, when we study children who don't have those experiences at home versus those who do, the children who don't behave better. It's as simple as that. It's counterproductive to hit children. But it was really common when I was a kid. I got hit when I was a kid. And every single one of my friends, for the most part, got hit when they were a kid. And that means that even though I don't look at my childhood as abusive in any way, shape or form, if my friend had said, oh, my dad hit me, it wouldn't really have occurred to me to have been something bad, because at the end of the day, very rarely, I would get a slap on the legs for doing something naughty. I wouldn't think, oh, what's the spectrum of abuse you're experiencing? Is it a slap on the wrist? Is it a slap on the legs? Or are you getting beaten? You'd have to very specifically tell me how grave your situation was as a child so that I could comprehend that it was different to what I was experiencing. And bear in mind, up until the late 70s, teachers could hit you. Unbelievable. I was in a class. This wasn't in the 70s, but I was in a class when this law had come in where you couldn't do that, but this teacher hadn't got the memo and she absolutely belted a kid in front of the whole class. Also, I went to a school where at times teachers would throw board dusters for the blackboard at you. So things being thrown at kids wasn't something that people weren't used to seeing. So again, even though she's saying sometimes daddy throws things at me, kids had more of an identity with that kind of malpractice and misbehavior of adults than they would do today. These days, if a child was saying, my dad throws things at me and my mum, kids would be like, that's so weird. That isn't okay. In fact, lots of children would be on the phones of something like the NSPCC, or they'd be investing in the parents saying, so-and-so's mum and dad do this, because they would understand that's not how families and men are work. But again, the alarm isn't raised because culturally, it's a time and place where these things happen, and probably because Judith herself doesn't understand just how grave her situation is. And the physical violence just gets worse. So Judith tells one of her friends that her dad threw pots and pans at her. One of those actually hit her in the face and gave her a nosebleed. I mean, he could kill her doing that. And Judith's friends became so scared of that house that she lived in because he was present, that they genuinely stopped knocking on the door because they were too afraid that if he came to the door, there would be consequences for themselves, but most importantly for Judith. Now, as months go by, this abuse that is clearly getting worse escalates. And it feels as if, as Judith is getting a little bit older, he is concentrating his abuse more on her. So on one occasion, he allegedly threw her to the ground by a ponytail and she was thrown so forcefully that it gave her a bloody nose. Now, bear in mind, she is there gravy train financially. That demonstrates that he has no care about the income to some degree. He's more concerned about his feelings. He's angry with her for being the embodiment of success. So damaging her face, it's not occurring to him that that would cause her issues with castings. Also, it's probably occurring to him that it's why she gets jobs. And he probably likes the idea of abusing that possibility by harming her physically. If he can distort the way that she looks features-wise, well, she's more likely to fail in the jobs that she goes for. And even though it's counterproductive because they won't get the money, when it comes down to his anger and resentment that she's better than he is, that will likely be the thing that wins. Yes, I'll destroy my income, but more importantly, I'll destroy her possibility of success. It also introduces us to a new reality, which is that Joseph's boundaries are getting more and more blurred. Because like I said, it makes absolutely no sense to affect your income badly, which she will do if she can't work or if something happens to her. But the fact he doesn't care about this means he has a lack of impulse control, but also maybe he's not thinking about the future. Maybe Joseph isn't that concerned about what happens next week, next year, next decade. Maybe he's thinking much shorter term as regard what's going to happen to that family. Now, clearly, Judith's life at home is becoming awful. And even when he's assaulted her in such a violent way that she's got a bloody nose, he has moments where he realises that his behaviour is out of control and feels bad, like we see in abusive situations. In fact, for that particular incident I talked about, he went out, he bought her a pink TV to go in her bedroom. And this is what abusive people do. They confuse you. Do you know what? It's almost easier to be somebody who's with a tyrant 100% of the time, who's never nice to you, who's always aggressive, who's always vile, because at least you know where you are with that kind of a person. You know they are bad through and through, but wow. The confusion you feel at any age, no matter who you are, when you are in a relationship with an abuser who is really violent and really nasty and really cruel at times, and then he's really sweet and really loving and really generous at times. It just means that you can't compute your environment, and children need to feel that an environment is consistent, even if that environment is consistently bad, because then it makes sense, this is bad. But when somebody is good to you, horrible to you, when you have to love them and loathe them all in the same moment, it is emotionally destabilizing and unbelievably challenging to live with. You just feel like you're treading on eggshells, but because they're kind to you at times, you just feel that maybe at root they do love you and it will be okay. That's why abusive situations are so challenging. It's why people stay in relationships where they're treated awfully, because they're not always treated awfully. We get to 1987. Judith is just 9 years of age at this moment in time. Both she and her mum, Maria, they're preparing to go to the Bahamas to film Jaws, The Revenge. Whilst they're doing this, again, it should be a cause for celebration. This is incredible. Joseph actually interrupts Judith, who's packing her suitcase, and puts a knife to her throat. Says, if you decide not to come back, I'll cut your throat. Now, she's 9. I'm pretty sure, don't get me wrong, that at 9 she probably would happily stay wherever they're filming for good. Because why would you want to come home to this kind of person? But the fact that he's suggesting that she has some kind of option, well, you know what, Dad, I was thinking about getting me an apartment just where we're filming and not coming home because I'm 9. And we all know that 9-year-olds are forever independently living. If I'm not walking down the street, seeing those 9-year-olds putting the bins out, sorting out the taxes, I don't know what a normal week is. But that suggests that he does not see her as a child. She's now in a position where he believes she's got choices, that she could choose of her own volition to leave him. It's so incorrect, just on a logic level. But then he isn't very logical. And he wants her to know, of course, that if she doesn't come back, something terrible is going to happen. But it's also a message to her mother, because if Judith wants to come home because she's afraid, then if her mother gets any ideas, the chances are that she will apply pressure to her mother to say, come home, because she'll be so concerned about the consequences if they don't. And obviously, Judith believes he's capable of this. Look at the way he's treating her. Now, Joseph's friend, Peter, he actually came forward after the event that this story is all about and said that Joseph had literally said he wanted to kill Maria over 100 times. And when Peter asked the question, well, what would happen to Judith? He replied, I gotta kill her too. Now, again, this is perfect representation of why we need to take these things seriously. For Peter, his friend is literally saying, I want to kill my wife, and by the way, I'm going to kill my child as well. He's saying, I'm going to annihilate my family. But Peter will not want to believe it because people don't want to believe it. But how many people in our lives do we know who are just randomly telling us they want to kill the family? If somebody says, not only I want to kill my partner, but I'm going to kill my child as well, ask yourself, have you ever had that conversation? If I had a friend say that to me, I would literally be on the phone to the police. I wouldn't even let them leave my home. I would take it that seriously. It's not a flippant comment. I've planned on killing my wife potentially, and I've thought out the fact that I'll have to kill my child as well. It just isn't something that human beings talk about. And if somebody speaks to you about this, you have to take it seriously. But Peter obviously believes that his friend isn't that capable of it and lets it slide, ultimately till it's too late. Now, we have Judith trying her best to get through the day, trying to get on with her childhood, her schooling, her work, but she starts to really emotionally struggle. She starts putting on weight. She actually develops a really compulsive behaviour, so trichotillomania, which is also known as trich, but trichotillomania is basically where you pull out your hair, your eyelashes. Apparently she even picked out her cat's whiskers, so it's like this compulsion to pull out hair. I'm sure some of you will have enjoyed it yourselves. And it's an anxiety response. It's a physical anxiety response. And even when we think about gaining weight, what people will say is, well, it's emotional eating. And that term is something that is so broad and really doesn't explain very much. So if you put it into this context, I specialized with eating disorders. I actually endured one when I was a young person for many years, and I had a keen interest. It's what I did my master's in psychology. But when we talk about emotional weight gain, we aren't saying that the person is emotional, therefore they're just eating. I mean, that just is just too simple and doesn't encapsulate the reality of what the person is dealing with. We're talking about somebody who is often so lost, scared, lonely. They have this emptiness within. And if you think about the old brain, the one that's been there forever, think about the amygdala, the instinct area. It doesn't interpret emotions like the more developed new brain thinks, you know, the more conscious and emotional brain. So if that area of the brain feels empty because we're feeling lonely, sad, lost, it seeks to deal with it. And it's like, oh, I've got an answer for that. I will feed, because the feeling of emptiness for the amygdala is make me full. So people who feel this sense of emptiness, loss, loneliness, etc., they'll eat. And it's not because they're greedy. It's because they're trying to fill a space that really they can't fill with food, but the amygdala believes can be, and it does it temporarily. And then, of course, you need to fill it again because those feelings come back. So this is likely what's going on for her. She has this real emotional sense of loss and sadness, fear, etc. And so she's dealing with that by eating. But the pulling out of hair, it's very complex, really problematic, quite difficult to deal with. A lot of people have gone through the experience of trich or skin picking, etc. It's something that becomes so compulsive and almost like you're not even thinking about it. It's a soothing reflex as well, that she is clearly in a huge amount of emotional turmoil and pain, and she's a kid, and this is what she's going through. Now, neighbours and relatives obviously know about the threats that Joseph is making, and one neighbour, somebody called Eunice Daly, they actually offered Maria Barcy refuge in her home. What an incredible person Eunice Daly was. She was somebody who actually did what so few people do in this world. She saw a problem and she created a solution. She believed that harm was going to come to both Maria and her daughter. And she was right. And she was willing to risk her own safety to try to make them safe. But Maria refused. And the reason that she refused, she said, I can't.
because he'll come after us and he'll kill us. And he's threatened to burn down the house. So essentially, she didn't want to put her neighbour at risk, even though ultimately that meant that she was even more at risk herself. May 1988. Judith is scheduled at this moment in time to audition for a song for this animated feature. Her agent said, "This is probably the moment when I realised that Judith genuinely was not okay. She was literally crying. She was hysterical. She genuinely couldn't even talk. So she realises something seriously is amiss. And as her agent, she wants to make sure that she takes care of this child. She's been a really known quantity to this point. Obviously, she's been doing really well and her career's on the up. She certainly wants to make sure that this situation can be managed. So she actually suggests to Maria to take her daughter to a child psychologist in Encino, which is something that they could afford. Now, whilst the therapist actually refused to discuss the case with Hanson, because clearly it's confidential, she said, "What I can tell you is this child is going through extreme verbal, mental and emotional problems." So something is so extreme in her life that it is causing an issue on every level and area of her well-being. It was so serious that the findings were actually reported to Child Services, but Maria apparently found Child Services were actually no help whatsoever. So she then said that she would personally handle it herself. Now, one of the Children's Services employees, somebody called Kleinberg, said that there was actually money in the budget, which would have meant they could remove Judith from the family home. The only problem was that that would ultimately mean that she'd be separated from her mother. And I understand that for Maria, that would not be perfect. Bear in mind, Maria and her daughter have got a really close relationship, but that would have made Judith safe. I understand the reticence that Maria had. I understand that she probably didn't want her daughter being taken from her, but the priority should have always been about Judith and her safety. I'm not blaming Maria. Maria's a victim. I'm just saying that sometimes we have to think about the bigger picture, not just the immediate feelings that we have about the smaller one. Now, Maria assured the caseworker that, "Listen, I know things are bad. I know things need to change. I'm going to divorce him." So she reassures them that things are going to change. So she said that she'd made plans for her and Judith to actually move to a flat in Panorama City. And she did. She rents this flat in Panorama City and she rented that apartment in May 1988. And she would basically spend her days there with Judith. Then she would return home at night. So she would go back to him at night. And she called that place her daytime haven. And I can completely understand and empathise with that. You just want a safe place, a place where you don't have to feel fear. And that's what they created. Now, Hanson, the agent, they actually, along with another group of friends, said to Maria, "Go through with your plan. Divorce him." But she kept hesitating. And this is so common. So many people want to get divorced and don't. They're either hoping it's going to change or they're worried about financial constraints, or they're afraid about consequences. All of those things play in, but it's no small decision getting divorced. And often people have got this connection with what marriage is meant to be like, even when it's imperfect, it's death till us part. And so you have these issues where you're dealing with the psychological, financial, social, and emotional constraints that you place upon yourself when you consider actually ending a relationship. And also, she said that she wanted to stay in the neighborhood because it was local to her. At the end of the day, she had lived there for a period of time. She didn't want to lose her home. And she had this certain level, I suppose, of luxury at the time. And we all know that divorces are costly and you end up having to share your money with your ex. And at the time, it was even more difficult for women. Splits were often not fair. And you're also thinking about the custody situation. Would she simply get custody? Or what if Judith was taken away from her and placed with him? So all these questions are clouding her judgment. And the really sad thing is that clouding of her judgment proves fatal. On the 6th of June, 1988, Judith turns 10, just 10 years old. They have this party at the house and apparently over the next month, the weather was really sunny and Judith was just out on a bike all the time, playing in the sprinklers, just living the dream as a child.
And you kind of think of that picture of the wild abandon of youth. It's just what we reflect on when we think of our childhoods often. You remember those heady days of sunshine and fun and freedom with a lack of responsibility that will one day surround you. And that was her experience for that month. But then on the 25th of July 1988, neighbours saw Judith playing outside on a pink bike. They didn't know that when they saw her doing that, it would be the last time they ever saw that little girl alive. In the evening, Maria puts Judith to bed before going to bed herself. She leaves Joseph at this point in the living room. He's drinking alone, as he often was. Joseph waited. He waited until he was absolutely certain that Maria was asleep. Then he went to a cupboard in his bedroom, and that was the cupboard where he kept his guns. He retrieved his .32 caliber pistol. Judith, of course, at this point is just sleeping peacefully. Little did she know that Joseph, her own father, was sneaking into her room, pointing a gun at her head and pulling the trigger. She died instantly. Understandably, the gunshot woke Maria. She got up in horror, immediately ran to the hallway. At this point, Joseph has left Judith's room and was making his way towards her. There was some kind of struggle. Maria definitely tried to push past him into her daughter's room. She wasn't concerned about her own safety. She just knew. She knew something terrible had happened to her little girl, this child that she adored. Her final moments were spent concerned about her child's welfare, not for her own. But as she struggles with him, he manages to wrestle Maria to the floor and then he just shoots her in the head, killing her too. Those moments for Maria, brief as they were, must have been consumed by the horror that something terrible had happened to her gorgeous little girl. And like I said, she had no care or consequence or concern for herself in those moments. Just the love that she felt for that child and the fear that she knew also in that moment for that child. For the next 2 days, Joseph just carries on, just living in the house as normal. Doesn't tell anybody what he's done. Didn't even move the bodies, just left them in situ. Now the next day, Judith is meant to be at an appointment at Hanna-Barbera Productions, huge production company. She's supposed to be recording a session for All Dogs Go to Heaven, and the studio get in touch with her agent because she's not come. She calls the Barcy household and Joseph does pick up the phone and says that basically, oh yeah, they've left. A big black car came to the house and took Maria and Judith to San Diego earlier that day, but don't know what it's for. He also then tells Ruth that he's decided to move out of the home for good, but plan to stick around long enough to say goodbye to his little girl. So totally living in a delusion. He said goodbye to his little girl. He said that with bullets, straight into her head, at point blank range. That was his goodbye to his little girl. The only thing that we can draw any sense of peace from is the fact that she died instantly. She will not have felt pain. She will have been asleep. And as she drifted into her dream state and finally into her death, we hope that she woke up in the most perfect paradise in the arms of a mother. But that's what he did to his child. His little girl, his beautiful, beautiful little girl. He executed her. That was his goodbye. Around 8:30 a.m. on the 27th of July 1998, one of the neighbours, Eunice, the amazing neighbour, who'd offered sanctuary in her own home, she hears what she thought was an explosion was coming from the Barcy house, and she went outside because she was watering her plants, and this is when she hears it. Immediately she calls 911, and she sees smoke coming out of the windows, and she runs over just trying her best to do what she can. And she actually has a garden hose because she's been out watering the plants, and she's trying to put the fire out while she waits for the fire department. Who would not wish for a neighbour like Eunice Daly? Just think about that for a minute. This is the woman who has said, please come, stay with me, bring your child, be safe. She's opened her door, her home, her heart. She's even put herself in a position where she could be at risk, but she did it willingly. And then when she hears the explosion and she sees the smoke, yes, she calls emergency services, but it's not enough for Eunice. No, she goes over to try to handle the fire herself. The world rarely creates humans like Eunice, but what an incredible person she is. When the firefighters arrive, it's pretty quick they realise they're not dealing with a house fire. Yes, the house is on fire, but that's not what they're going to find. Instead, it's three dead bodies, not burnt. That's not what's killed them. They find Judith, who's 10, Maria, who's 48, and Joseph, who's 55. There's a gasoline cap that's been discarded in Judith's room, and it seemed that the way that he was trying to burn down the house was that he'd doused both the bodies of his wife and daughter in gasoline before setting them on fire. Joseph had then gone into the garage and he'd shot himself with the same gun that he'd used to kill his family. That was the explosion that Eunice had actually heard. It was in fact a gunshot. When she spoke to the Los Angeles Times, she said, my first thought as I ran in to call 911 was, he's done it. He's killed them and set fire in the house just like he said he would. She was 100% correct. The fact that he set them on fire as well. I mean, they were dead already. What's that about? Was it about trying to disguise his actions so that maybe the bodies would have been so burnt that they wouldn't have been able to find that he'd actually shot them? Or was it simply that he wanted them to burn because he wanted to punish them further? He wanted to steal the opportunity for family members to ever see them again, to hold them in their arms one last time before they were taken. Because that's what you do when you burn somebody so badly. And the fact that he then goes and shoots himself, well, that's not because he was suicidal. That's because he was a coward. That's because he knew the ramifications were that he'd be seen for the failure, the murder, or the bastard that he absolutely was. That was why he did it, without a doubt. The burial happened on the 9th of August, 1988. Judith and Maria Barcy were buried in an unmarked graves, unmarked, at the Forest Lawn Memorial Park in the Hollywood Hills. In 2004, 16 years later, Judith's awesome fans, who'd grown up, they crowdfunded enough money to purchase headstones for both graves, and they are beautiful headstones. Judith's headstone reads, in memory of the lovely Judith Eva Barcy, our concrete angel. Yep, yep, yep. This is in reference to the character Ducky's catchphrase in The Land Before Time, which had been voiced by Judith. And how beautiful. People are gorgeous, aren't they? On this channel, I cover a lot of terrible things, but the slivers of light and hope always come from the kindness of human beings. Human beings that in this case didn't even know Judith, apart from the characters that she played, and yet still felt it was wrong that those graves were unmarked. And it was. I don't have any idea why the state didn't step in and make sure that the accolades were given, or that the organisations she made money for didn't provide the headstones. Even the agent. Why should a cash cow, once they're dead, not be represented for the worth that they had in their life? It's so beautiful that the fans came to the rescue. Now, though Judith Barcy died in July 1988, what we can say is that to some degree she'll always live on. Her acting, it means that she's always present, even though she's no longer here. So two of her animated films, they actually came out after her death. That was The Land Before Time. They came out in 1988. That was apparently her favourite acting role. And in All Dogs Go to Heaven, that was released in 1989, Judith played Anne Marie, who was an orphan who could talk to animals. And the film ends actually with the song Love Survives. And that was dedicated specifically to Judith's memory. The director of both the films, a guy called Don Bluth, he said that Judith was absolutely astonishing. He said, as an actress, she was incredible. She understood verbal direction, even for the most sophisticated situations. And Bluth stated that he had absolutely 100% intended to feature her extensively in future productions. Bonnie Gold, who was a spokeswoman for Judith's acting agency, she said she was very successful. With every door open to her, there was no telling how far she would have gone. Now, in 2020, a bit of a weird thing happened. So the Bernal family, they'd moved in to the Barcy household and they said that they felt really uncomfortable from the get-go. They said that they felt that the house was haunted, that they felt, as they put it, a dark presence. And they actually went on an episode of Murder House Flip. They said that the garage door would just randomly open and close on its own, and they felt these really cold spots throughout the house. And Gabby Bernal, who slept in the same bedroom that Judith was actually murdered in, apparently suffered terrible nightmares. Now, the team brightened up the colours in the house to allow for basically more natural light, which the new owners had said just really improved things. So I'm just going to throw it out there to the family. Probably you knew something really awful had happened in the house, particularly your child who was like, I'm literally sleeping in a room where a little girl was horribly executed. And that's what gave her nightmares. I know, somebody will say, she didn't know about it. The way I look at it is, people realise why houses are cheaper when they're sold. We all know. Dharma's place went for a lot less than the other places in the area went for, because people are like, you know, it's nice, but I really don't want to be in there when I think about what happened. You know, I like a nice home just like anybody else does. You know, if I was walking around a home and the estate agent was like, have you noticed the price? Oh my God, I've noticed the price. It's amazing. I can't believe it. I love this area. And yet, this is £80,000 less. Yes, it's great, isn't it? And it's got such lovely bathrooms. It has got lovely bathrooms. Yeah, I love it. I'm genuinely thinking of putting in the offer. Right. Well, have you heard about the history of the home? Well, I know it's quite an old home. I know that it's a home that's been here for a long time because I've driven past it a lot and thought, well, I'd like to own that. Yeah. Right. Have you heard about any problems with the home? Nope. Nope. I just love it. Right. There may be some information you need to know. Oh God, is it a bad neighbour? I know legally you have to tell people about bad neighbours. I mean, £80,000 less than the normal asking price would still mean that I could probably cope with a bad neighbour. It's not a bad neighbour. Basically, there's been a series of murders in the house. I was thinking about maybe going for a semi as opposed to a detached. Do you know what that bathroom? I don't know whether I do like the bathrooms. I think the bathrooms were too big. I'm going to go compact. I'm leaving now. Honestly, that would be me. I know some people are like not emotionally attached to stuff like that, but I do not want to be anywhere near a house that somebody's been murdered in. And I know that some of you watching will be like, well, I'd be fine with it, because at the end of the day, people die in houses all the time. For me, though, the idea of being around the energy of that just puts me off. But I don't think for one moment that it's because Judith was haunting the area. Judith is a beautiful, innocent child, as was Maria, as her mother. There's no way their souls are trapped in the home. There's no way. They're in paradise, in my opinion. But I do think if you move in somewhere like that, you're gonna potentially be affected by the knowledge of what occurred. And even if you didn't know when you bought, the neighbours are gonna tell you. So it makes sense the child would have nightmares. And it makes sense that when people came in and went, miraculously, we've made it look so lovely now, that it changes the state of mind and the psychology of the experience, and therefore the people stay. Brightening the colours of the house to let more natural light in just means the house felt less spooky, and the impact of that psychologically was it felt that it was no longer haunted. It's not as if the ghosts, if they had existed, would be like, oh my God, they've only gone and brightened up the decor. This magnolia is never going to do. I can't haunt here. Is there another house in the local area that's maybe gone for a dark teal or, I don't know, gunpowder grey? Let's get our ghosting stuff together and go there. Anyway, they came back in the news because of that. I guess what is so heartbreaking about this story is the strong likelihood is that this girl with everything to live for would be all over our screens even today, a very veteran of the acting world, a success in her own right, with more money than she would have known what to do with. If only she hadn't had such a malevolent, evil, psychopathic, narcissistic, Machiavellian father. But sadly, she was born to Joseph, and that's absolutely who she got. I don't believe she'll ever see him again, though. Because as you all know, people like Joseph, they don't end up surrounded in light and love. They go to an altogether more fiery place. And I wish him every moment of eternal hell as he spends the duration of eternity right beside the devil himself.
That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.